This is Meredith Campbell on behalf of the Northern Territory Archives Service Oral History Unit, interviewing Reg Harris at Alice Springs on October 23, 1996. This is side B of tape number 4 of the interview. Reg, harking back to our earlier recollections about the early days of football in Alice Springs, and you mentioned one season you had to play at what is now known as the Olive Pink Flora Reserve. And I take it that at some point you had some contact with the old lady.
Yes, the tennis courts, which were located on the corner of Todd Street and Gregory Terrace, now Council Lawns, we used to go down there some mornings and play a game of tennis. And the redoubtable Miss Pink lived next door in an ex-army provost hut, unlined tin hut. And she had a few vines growing around the outside of it. And this particular morning, someone hit the ball over the fence into Miss Pink's yard. So I just hopped over the fence and went in to pick the ball up. And all of a sudden, this fiery little lady dressed in flowing white gowns came out, demanding to know what was I doing in there stealing her grapes. And I tried to tell her I wasn't interested in her grapes. So I was only looking after the ball, and she said, "That's no excuse, you're in here after the grapes." And I said, "Look, I come from a grape-growing district, I don't want your grapes." But I couldn't convince her that I wasn't there to pinch the grapes, so I sort of kept an eye open for this little old lady. And then my next meeting with her, she came to me one day, and she had this old electric jug, just about come out of the ark, I think. And she said, "You're an electrician, can you fix my jug for me?" And I said, "Yes, I think I can." Should have really thrown it away and got another one, but anyhow, after spending ages on it, I managed to get it to pieces and fix it up. And knowing that I'd learned a lot more about it by this time, I knew she had very little money, but also that she was fiercely independent. So I took the jug back and I said, "Well, look, that'll be $2. And she looked on her purse and she's scraping around and she's bringing out pennies and sixpences. And I knew that if I said, "Look, you can have it for nothing," I would have got roundly abused. So I said, "Oh, look, Miss Pink, I just realised we used some second-hand parts in it and it's only 1 6. And I dared not go any lower because I'd have got the wrath of the old lady." So we sort of become quite friendly after that, and she lived in this this unlined hut on Gregory Terrace. And next door to her, there was another hut, which they originally set up the Alice Springs Fire Brigade in. and of course, these young blokes, as firemen, would be there all hours of the night, playing music and making a noise and perhaps swearing and that. And Miss Pink would constantly complain to the administration about these terrible firemen annoying her all the time. And of course, when she went out and screamed at them to stop doing this or that, quite often they'd turn the hose on her. So it turned out that she took them to court and won. They had to stop playing music after the hours of midnight, and they weren't allowed to put the hose on her or swear at her. And because that didn't please the then district officer, Reg McCaffrey, who certainly was not a Miss Pink supporter. And so he had her evicted from her hut. And this old lady, who by that time was probably close to 80, spent some 6 months camping in someone's backyard. But she did have higher friends right up until to the ministers. All the top public servants and ministers from Canberra all admired Miss Pink and helped her as much as they could. So they actually gave this hut, or gave it to her for a sum of about £5. I think they had to have some sort of payment. And the Northern Territory Administration would have to put it up for her on a block of land which they granted her on the east side of the Todd, now known as the Olive Pink Flora Reserve. But anyhow, these these government, local government bureaucrats who had no time for Miss Pink would not erect the hut. So she actually, on the Flora Reserve, she camped under a tree for something like a year and a half before her hut was finished. Then she started to do this, do up this little flora park, and they gave an honorarium because she refused to take the pension. She didn't think that people should have a pension, and she had been retired from the New South Wales Railways in the middle of the Depression, and I forget, she got just a small sum of money a fortnight, which was about $6 or $7 a fortnight, and that was what she tried to live on. For a while she used to grow some flowers and sell them in the on the street, and but anyhow, when she went over onto this flora reserve, the minister and the head of the Northern Territory Department gave her what they called an honorarium. And it just so happened it equaled the old age pension, and it didn't take much to work out that she was getting the pension in a backhand way. And anyhow, one time she got a rise, and one of her elderly friends she spoke to and said, I've got my rise in the honorarium. And the other one said, of course you did, we all got it, it's a rise in the pension. So she sent it all back, and pinched and scraped to earn it and sent the rises back. But a Northern Territory government official managed to convince her that it was just happened to be a coincidence that she got the rise the same day as the pension. Well, my next connection with Miss Pink, I was on the town management board, and she would come in and berate everybody about what should be done, what was being done wrongly, etc. And Frank Dwyer was the Northern Territory Department Secretary, which means he was doing the job that now the Northern Territory government does. He was completely in charge of the territory. And she used to, and of course, being a government bureaucrat and a Catholic, was Miss Pink's most hated person. And she would come in and roundly abuse Frank and the town management board over what should be done. Frustrated Frank so much, he one time said, pity this woman didn't have any money because we could have a lot of it if we took her to court. And then he suddenly woke up. Here's a lady in her late 80s, probably older than his own grandmother, and he's treating her as he would some other government bureaucrat or some big businessman who was trying to upset him. So Frank discovered that she liked yellow flowers, and he found out when her birthday was, and on her birthday he would always send her a bunch of yellow flowers. And when he came to Alice Springs, he would have his secretary ring Miss Pink to see if he could have an appointment with her. And this tickled the old lady no end, of course, and she'd always set up the sherry and everything to entertain Frank Dwyer. And, of course, instead of being that terrible person, he suddenly became my dear Shylock because he was in charge of all the money. And a similar thing happened at the... with the district office, people like McCaffrey, there was no way that she would ever be allowed into his office. And of course she would go along and stir up the whole of the general office for a half an hour or so, trying to get in to see McCaffrey. Well, McCaffrey went, and we had a very good public servant called Bill Nordsan arrived in town. And he's in his office one day and he hears this racket going on outside, and he walked down or called his secretary in and said, what's that racket out there? Oh, she said, that's a terrible Miss Pink trying to get in to see you. But we never let her in. And he said, well, things have changed. I want to see her. Let her in. So Miss Pink came in, sat down in the chair in Bill's office and sat. And he said, what do you want, Miss Pink? And she didn't say anything. She just sat. And eventually he said, Miss Pink, the only reason you came into the office was because you knew, or thought you knew, you wouldn't get in to see me, and that you were going to throw a tantrum and disturb the office. And she said, yes, that's right. And he said, well, Miss Pink, I'll reserve a quarter of an hour every day just for you. You can come in at 9:45 and you must leave at 10, and that's available to you every day of the week. She accepted, hardly ever took up the offer, and of course Nord Zen became one of her favourite people. She even planted a tree after him and all. So the old lady could be handled quite easily if with some diplomacy instead of just being nasty to her. She used to go into the court, and if an Aboriginal was being tried on something, if she objected to something that was happening, she'd hop up in the middle of it and scream at the magistrate that he wasn't doing his job properly. And then she got the idea that the jail wasn't looking after the Aborigines properly, and she demanded to be calmed down, taken down and taken over for an inspection of the jail. But there's no way that anyone was going to let her do that. So she did some minor misdemeanor that had her arrested. She was taken into court, and I think she was fined £1 or 2 days in jail or something like that. So of course she wouldn't pay the fine. She opted for the 2 days in jail, and the jailer at that time was one Phil Muldoon, and he, when he heard about it, he immediately rushed up to the courthouse and paid the fine to keep Miss Pinky out of the jail. So and I believe a lot of her her thoughts and writings on Aborigines are being adopted by present day governments. This is something she's done 50 years ago. Another encounter I had with this funny old lady, she came to me, and she was living in this still the same tin hut that had finally been erected on the Pink Reserve, and of course it was unlined, and in the summer it became an oven. And she was in her 80s, and she came to me and said, "You sell air conditioners, can you put an air conditioner in my hut?" And I went and had one look at it, and I thought, well, you know, if she could ever afford the size air conditioner it would need to cool the hut, she'd never be able to afford the running costs. So as it happened, it was a firm in Adelaide had sent me an air cooler, a new type of air cooler that they wanted me to try out. So I got a young bloke that worked for me, and Sid Kinsman, and another young bloke who worked at the Dunlop Tire Service, and the four of us went over to Miss Pink's One Australia Day, and we told her to go outside and sit under a tree, and we spent Australia Day. We built her this little room inside of her tin hut. It was fully lined with kainite and that, and we painted the duck egg blue, put the air conditioner in, and I put a little fridge in, and we shifted her telephone inside and put in a fluorescent light. Well, she came in and she was a bit overcome, but she insisted the fluorescent light go out. She only wanted an ordinary light, not a fluorescent. She didn't want the telephone in her room, so that had to be taken out. And she didn't want a fridge because she was quite happy with putting a food under on a wet patch under her table, and that was her fridge. So, of course, she then wrote a letter to everybody telling everyone what a great fellow I was and how I'd done this and saved her life and oh, God knows what. But then some years later, her Aboriginal gardener, Johnny, died. And I rang Miss Pink and said, "Do you want to go to Johnny's funeral?" She said, "No, women shouldn't go to funerals, you go." And I said, "I don't want to go, I don't even know him." She said, "I want you to go and represent me." I said, "All right, well, what's all happening?" She said, "Well, he's a heathen, and I wanted him buried as a heathen, but I'm not allowed to do that, so I've got the next best. I've arranged Paul Albrecht to bury him." And I don't know what that says for Paul Albrecht, if he's the next best of a heathen, but anyhow. So the day of the funeral, I rang the funeral director, one Jack McGaskill, and I said, "What time's Johnny been buried?" He said, "Oh, God," he said, "3 o'clock, but there's a big problem." He said, "A long-lost daughter's arrived. He's been converted to a Catholic, and she wants her father buried as a Catholic." And he said, "It's going to be hell to pay if Miss Pink finds out." And I said, "Well, for God's sake, don't ever let her know." So anyhow, I went over to the Catholic church. They left Johnny out in the hearse, and I think the funeral service in the church lasted 50 seconds. and then they carted him out to the cemetery, and the graveside service lasted 1 minute, and in went Johnny. So I came back and rang Miss Pink and said, "Hey, the funeral went over fine. Everything's fixed, Miss Pink." "Okay." So the next day she rang me and said, "Who buried Johnny?" And I said, "I don't know. They all look the same to me in their long white frocks." And she said, "He was buried a Catholic and you knew it." And I said, "Yes, okay, but so what could I do?" She said, "You should have stopped it." And then she hung up, bang, went the phone. I thought, well, that's the end of that relationship. And how she'd found out, apparently, Adam Walkup's son, who was involved with an Aboriginal department, thought he was doing the right thing, and he went over and told Miss Pink what a nice funeral it was, and it was a nice Catholic service and all that sort of stuff, and that blew the old lady away, of course. So then I get after she banged the receiver down on me, I get the next letter. "You are too concerned with tourism and Rotarianism," that's the way she spelled it, "to be concerned with me, so it's time to say farewell, come and get your air cooler back." She'd forgotten that I'd built the place. She then thought that Sid Kinsman was the one who built the room, you see, and she'd forgotten all about that. So otherwise I'd have had to go and pull the room down too, I suppose. But anyhow, there's no way I was going to go and get the air cooler back, so she finally got Glenn Hewitt to go and take it down. I don't know why the hell he did that, but anyhow, he took the air cooler down. And then he came round to my workshop and he said, "Well, I've taken your old air cooler out. Have you got another one you can give me?" And I said, "No, if you want another one, you get one from the works or somewhere." So he was chief engineer at the Department of Works, and he got one of the air coolers and brought them round to my blokes to fix it up. Then, of course, it broke down, and apparently she couldn't get anyone that could fix it. And it must have hurt the old girl, because when she cuts someone off, she never ever goes back to them again. And she rang me and said, "My air cooler's broken down. Do you think you can come and fix it for me?" And I just told her to go to hell and hung up on her like she would have done to me if I'd have rung her in the first place. So I let her ring another time and I hung up on her. And then the third time I said, "All right, I'll come and fix your air cooler, but I don't want you to speak to me. In fact, I don't even want to see you. You can go and move around and just sit under a tree somewhere where I can't look at you." And from that day onwards, we became firm friends again. And another aside with this room we built, which she called her igloo, I built the thing and she kept wanting to pay me for it. She knew the air cooler was on loan, but she knew that I would have supplied the stuff. And I tried to get out of taking money off the old lady, and I told her that all the timber was from a fire that we'd had. We'd had a fire in our premises in Todd Street. I said, "Oh, this is all the fire damaged timber that you've got, so it's not worth anything." And she said, "Well, all that kainite's new. I want to pay you for that." And I said, "Oh, well, I haven't got a bill for it." Well, one day she met up with Bill Hill, who was the local agent for kainite. And she said, "How much is a sheet of kainite?" And he told her. And she said, "I knew that Harris was telling lies when he told me he didn't know." And then Bill immediately woke up to what was happening, and he said, "Oh, hang on." He said, "That's the first grade stuff." He said, "What I sold him was only second grade. It's only half the price of that. That's about as much as he could do to cover things up." So she eventually paid me half the cost of the cane up, and that just shows what a fiercely independent old lady she was. So she another occasion, there was a very well-known commentator called Keith Smith. He was very famous for a session he had a world from with children. It was one of the most popular shows on radio. And Keith Smith came to Alice Springs for the sole purpose of interviewing two fiery old ladies, Mrs. Jenkins, the Apple Queen, and Miss Pink. And he asked someone, could he ever get an audience with these two ladies? And someone suggested that he try me, as I was friends with both of them and I might be his only chance. Well, I didn't have a lot of trouble getting the interview with Mrs. Jenkins. That went over all right. And I rang Miss Pink, and after a while she said, "All right, I'll let him interview me on the condition he does not mention this flora park. He can talk to me about Aborigines as long as he likes, but he must not mention the flora park." So, okay, I made that quite clear to Smith, and he accepted. So he went over and conducted the interview, asked all about her work with Aborigines and that, and it went over really well. And then the great day came, and the ABC played this Keith Smith program, interviewing these two famous ladies. Well, when Miss Pink's come on, she wouldn't have a radio in her house because she'd got enough of loud music from the fire brigade, so she had no radio. So I rang her up and I said, "Miss Pink, your interview's on. I'll put the receiver near the radio and you can hear it." "All right," she said. Well, the first thing this stupid Keith Smith said, "Now I'm now going to interview Miss Pink, who operates a flora park on the outskirts of Alice Springs, but I'm not allowed to mention it." Oh, God, you know. I quick picked the phone up, but all I got was the engaged signal. She had hung up. And I thought, well, that's the end of my friendship. But anyhow, she wasn't annoyed with me at all. She was just annoyed with him. And the Christmas after he did the interview, he sent her a Christmas card. She looked at it, threw it on the floor, and jumped on it. And I think, to the best of my knowledge, that stayed on the floor for something like 2 years. Every time some stranger would come in, she'd tell him about this horrible Keith Smith and pick the thing up off the floor and show it to him and then throw it back on the floor again. Now, in her last days, she decided that she was going to die before another hot summer. And she didn't leave her little park for over a year prior to this starting her death period. And after about 12 months, I went in to her place, and of course, to go into Miss Pink's, there was a gate on the road. For a long time, she used to tie it up. The gate would be shut. Apart from the lock on the gate, then she'd put a strand of rope around and tie it. And then after a while, she had two strands of rope around it. And if you just went in to see her for 10 minutes, if she found out she didn't shut the gate and put two strands of rope around it, she'd blow the hell out of you. So, anyhow, I went in this day to see her, and I said, "I want you to hop in the car." And she did, surprisingly enough. And I just drove her out of her property and drove her all around the town. The new hospital had just been completed, and she was quite impressed with that. So then I brought her up here for coffee. And she's having a cup of coffee, and she said to Marge, "Could I have a look at this house?" So Marge sort of showed her around the house and took her into our bedroom. And suddenly, Miss Pink drew herself up to a full height and turned around and glared at Marge and said, "Why haven't I been introduced to this lady?" And Marge looked around and said, "Miss Pink, that's not a lady. That's your reflection in a full-length mirror." And, of course, the old girl was highly amused by that. I think she chuckled about that for the rest of the afternoon, about this in the high mirror. So, anyhow, she decided that she was not going to see another summer out and she would die before the summer. So she started to give things away. She gave Marge her bone china cups, which she'd originally bought for hand painting but never got around to it. She gave me some of her prized photographs. Our younger son, she gave an old battered table that she had, and our elder son was to have her old bed. And I used to say to her, "Well, why can't he have it now?" She said, "No, I've got to die first, and you can have the bed after I'm dead." So anyhow, she didn't die that summer, and it was a very hot summer. And the next winter, the middle of winter, she'd been a bit sick, and there's no way she would have gone into hospital, but she had been a bit sick, and the district nurse called on her every day. And anyhow, this particular morning, the district nurse arrived, and Miss Pink was lying on the floor, thinly clad, middle of winter, with the air cooler going full bore. And of course they raced her off to hospital, but she never ever regained consciousness. I went down and saw her, and she was freezing cold all over. And no one will ever convince me that she didn't commit suicide, because she just didn't want to live through another summer. And the other thing, of course, that I'd always joked with her, she said, "When I die, I want to be buried in an unmarked grave in the Aboriginal cemetery." And I said, "No way, I'm going to put a headstone on your grave, and I might even put an angel." And she used to laugh and say, "Well, that's all right, so long as it's a black angel." And anyhow, when the day came, her last wish was to be buried in the Aboriginal part of the cemetery. and that the only flowers permitted would be a bunch of violets to be dropped onto her coffin by Marge Harris, that she was allowed to bring a bunch of violets to her. And so this was all done, of course. Well, 12 months later, I went to find the grave, and I was going to put something on it. But when I got there, I found out there was already a headstone on it, a nice natural sandstone. And the amazing thing about it was that every headstone in that cemetery faces east. Miss Pink's faces west. Well, Glenn Hewitt was the one that she had as her executor. I was for a long time, but after the problem with the Johnny's funeral, I was taken off, and Glenn Hewitt was the sole executor then. And I asked him, how come the gravestone? And he said, well, she did leave, despite the fact what she said, she did leave a little bit of money that enabled him to put this simple natural stone on our grave. And but I cannot find out from him or anyone else why her gravestone faces the opposite direction to everyone else. Anything I can think of, the cantankerous old lady got up and shifted it. And that's most of my recollections of the famous old Miss Pink, which if all the bureaucrats that had trouble with her treated her as they would their own grandmother, well, maybe they wouldn't have had the strife that they did.
So, Reg, would you describe it as a complex, although rewarding, friendship?
I think so, yes. Particularly now, the high esteem which Miss Pink is held in all over Australia, and you know, they're talking about making a film of her, and there's a Miss Pink Society in Sydney, and I think it's one of the highlights of my life to be considered that I was a friend of the famous old Miss Pink.
Did she, because she did espouse her very supportive theories about Aborigines, did she have many Aboriginal friends?
No, I didn't see a lot. It was always claimed that that they couldn't be bothered with her. Whether that's so or not, I don't know. But she used to spend, when she first came here, a lot of time out in the Tanami Desert with tribes out there on her own. And this was this old lady who was scared of the night time and scared of thunder, and yet she managed to spend time out in the bush with these Aborigines. But the popular story was, of course, that they didn't have any time for anyhow. Maybe this was just wishful thinking from these so-called bureaucrats that didn't want her to be successful. But there's a young woman around here that's doing a lot of writing about her called Linda Clack. And she tells me that she's got a whole lot of Miss Pink's writings on what should be done with Aborigines. And apparently it's similar to what's being done by different governments now, or attempting to be done. But I didn't concern myself a lot with Aborigines. I told her that I didn't want to talk about her work in the Flora Park or her work with the Aborigines. I was only interested in her personally as a friend and not in her work, so she never discussed anything with me like that.
Now, there's a myth that's going around, that's been around for a while, that she planted a tree and ascribed it a name, maybe of a politician, and if she didn't like the politician, she'd let the tree wither and die.
That's a popular story, but I've never found that to be proved correct, because I don't think Miss Pink was the type to let a tree die. I think that if she could possibly rename it after someone else. But I think many trees died, of course, in the drought and that. And I think that's what promoted this myth that when someone fell out of tune with it, she would let the tree die. But I can't believe that. There's another interesting thing about the power of this old lady. I told you earlier about how she had the gate, and as well as the lock, it had to have two strands of rope around it. Well, 2 weeks after she died, I went past there, and that gate was still shut with two strands of rope around it, and yet there'd been dozens and dozens of cars from the Northern Territory government in and out of there after she died. So the old lady's presence was so strong that even 2 weeks after she died, there was another great story about her, that she had one true love. He was a captain in the army, and he was killed in Gallipoli. and she never ever married or had another boyfriend. Always referred to him as my great friend, never as my fiance or anything, always my great friend. And she did not believe in putting photographs up around the room, but every Anzac Day and on birthdays and Christmas, she would display for the one day the photograph of my very dear friend and her mother and father. They would be on a little table by her bed. And there was a great story that went around that she always kept the wedding frock that she had made to marry this captain when he came back from the war, and that it was her wish that she had it stored away, and that she wanted to be buried in it. And anyhow, when she died, I was the first one to have a look, and I made sure that there was no wedding frock anywhere in her little old hut. So, you know, apparently that was a myth, unless someone else managed to get it otherwise.